The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday afternoon California time space show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. Great show with one of our favorite guests we haven't heard from since 2018. We're really happy to have Dr. Seedhouse back with us today. More about that in just a minute. A couple of very short announcements. Today is a 90-minute format program, so please still watch your clock if you want to talk to Eric or send in an email. Make sure you do it while we're still on air. In addition, for the week coming up, there will be no Friday program. This is because I have non-space show matters that I have to attend to, and the only day available to do it with these people was Friday. So, unfortunately, there will be no space show program on Friday of this week. So we have Hotel Mars that's updating us on what's going on with OSIRIS-REx and Bennu and the sample return. And on Tuesday, we're getting an update from Christopher Richens and RBC Signals. And Sunday, November 1st, is our Open Lines program. Going back to today's program, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll get you up on air just as quickly as possible. You can also use email to reach us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments or ask questions via our blog, which is the spaceshow.com website, all the way to the far right upcoming show menu. And the first show listed is with Dr. Seedhouse. Click on that show. That's our archive page as well as our blog page. And you scroll down to the bottom, you'll see comments. And post your comment, ask your question, hit send. And as soon as I get it, I'll be able to bring your commentary or question into the mix with our guest today. So those are the three ways to reach it. Although, keep in mind, we are a radio talk show, which implies that we like to talk. So we prefer you use the toll-free line, and hopefully you will do that. But if for some reason you can't or refuse, then, of course, email or posting on our blog is absolutely acceptable. let's see, what else? There is a menu in the upper left on our website that has a couple of important items. Listen Live tells you how to listen to the live broadcast like we're doing now, and you're certainly welcome to share that information. And it also tells you how to listen to podcasts as well as archives right off of our website. And in addition, if you know of other platforms for podcasts that you would like us to be in, please send me your list and we'll see if we can't get listed in them. We're in most common platforms, regardless of the type of platform you're using. But if you have a favorite and we're not covered in it, we'd love to get that email from you. So please do that. The other thing to point out is that we are a listener-supported program, which means that those of you listening, people just like you, financially contribute to us, and that allows us to do these programs and bring you great guests like Tori Bruno from Friday and Dr. Seedhouse today and lots of others. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. And for those of you that pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And if you have any questions, our nonprofit parent website is onegiantleapfoundation.org, or just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a big PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. But if you want to use a check, you make it out to One Giant Leap Foundation, and you mail it to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And again, for questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We couldn't be doing this program without you, and it's listeners just like you who are listening right now, either on archives or the live show, that keep us going, and we greatly thank you and appreciate that. We will be starting our annual campaign in early November, which is just around the corner. And I know this is a challenging and difficult year for lots of people. It is for the space show, too. So hopefully keep that in mind, and we look forward to a great 2021 with all of you as well. We also do have sponsors, and I'll say more about that when we break between first and second segment. But all those banner ads you see crossing our homepage, those are from our great sponsors. So, again, when we break for first to second segment, I'll tell you more about our excellent sponsors. So, Eric Seedhouse is back with us, and Eric and I were just looking up right before the show started. He was last on the show in 2018, but we went back to 2015, and Eric was probably our most prolific author that has ever been on the space show, and he was really knocking out some great books, and he would be a guest on three or four times a year. So I guess he's, now that he's a professor, he's slowed down a little bit in writing all of his books, but he does have two books that he's going to talk about today. But he is also a professor of space flight operations and human factors aviation safety at Emory-Riddle. And he has practical experience and theoretical experience in many of the subjects. He has a textbook called Life Support Systems for Humans in Space, which is excellent. All of you would absolutely love to have a copy of this, I guarantee you. And he has a new science fiction book out that we are also going to talk about, Terminal Reality. You can read all of Eric's bio. It's published on the Space Show website. We're ready to talk with Eric. Dr. Seedhouse, welcome back to the Space Show. Where have you been hiding for the last 2 years?
Well, thanks for having me back, David. Appreciate it. And, yes, not a question of slowing down. It's just a question of burnout, really. So when I set out to start writing, my bucket list was to write a bookshelf of books. And my bookshelves, which I'm looking at right now, just happen to hold 30 books. So this is the science fiction novel was the 30th book. So that's it. Mission accomplished, basically.
Well, you can get another bookshelf.
I think 30 is enough. I mean, I'll still do second edition. So I promised Clive, who's in charge of practice books, that I'll do a second edition of SpaceX, so that's coming out next year. We were just waiting for the first operational flight, which will take place next month. And then that'll be a second edition. We'll probably do a second edition of Virgin Galactic, but obviously we're going to wait until I actually start flying passengers before we do that. So from now on, it'll just be second editions of some of those books.
You have a textbook, Life Support Systems for Humans in Space, which is absolutely excellent, and the topics in it, it's very comprehensive, great photographs, great pictures. So, and then you have a science fiction book. So why a textbook? What made you decide you wanted to write a textbook?
Well, first of all, the last textbook or last book of any kind or shape of description written on the subject of life support for spaceflight was almost a quarter of a century ago, 24 years ago in 1996, Peter Eckhart's book, which is Spaceflight, Life Support, and Biospherics, which is an excellent book. It's written more from an engineering perspective, but of course this was written in 1996 before the space station even flew. And of course, an awful lot has changed. I mean, a lot has changed even since I published this book this year in life support. And I teach life support at the undergraduate level. I teach it at the master's degree level. And also teach it at also teach it for the Institute, or the International Institute for Astronomical Sciences. And it's just easier to have a dedicated textbook for the students, because otherwise you're just sending them lots and lots of articles saying this is good reading material, this is good reading material. And after a while they're just swamped. So it's just easy for them to just pick up one book and have all that, all the information they need in one book. And that was the intent with this book.
How did you put it together? Are you the sole source? Did you go to aerospace medicine doctors and scientists and engineers specializing in this? What was your methodology? I guess that's the question.
Okay, well, Eckhart's book is very much engineering. So it basically describes the engineering concepts of how a subsystem works or how an assembly works, like how a carbon dioxide removal assembly works, for example. You know, the engineering features. And there's a little bit of that in my book, but it's more physiology-based. And also, there's no standardized categorization of a life support system. So, for example, in Mercury space flight, there were two subsystems. In the Apollo command module, there were five subsystems. In the space shuttle, there were eight subsystems. And in the International Space Station, there were six subsystems. For example, in the space shuttle, food was a subsystem of a life support system. But that subsystem doesn't appear in any other spacecraft. And, of course, there are some topics, like countermeasures, exercise countermeasures, for example. That's a key life support subsystem, but it's not mentioned in any spacecraft. And so my approach was more of a physiology approach to look at all the aspects of life support, not just the subsystems. So if you just looked at the subsystems, you'd be looking at a very dry book, looking at the six subsystems of the ISS. But I wanted to include psychology, because that's an important life support topic. I wanted to look at exercise countermeasures. That's very important. And I wanted to look at EVA, spacewalks, because that's very important for life support as well. And then finally, I wanted to sort of look ahead to looking at how life support systems can be closed, because you need to do that before you can go to Mars. And the biggest technology gap right now is biomass, basically growing food, because we can't do that in space. We can do it with things like lettuce and radishes, but they don't get you very far on our interplanetary mission.
What kind of food are you talking about growing?
Well, so the first food that astronauts actually ate in space was romaine lettuce in August 2015 with Scott Kelly. That was during Scott Kelly's 340-day mission. And obviously, it's not – people see the Martian, they think, oh, we can do that, but we can't. Not in space, because all sorts of processes, signaling mechanisms, things like that, we don't understand, and we don't understand how they work in space. And so it's a lot of hit and miss. You know, you have to regulate the temperature, you have to regulate the humidity, what's the effect of radiation, gravitropism, which is a signaling mechanism that plants have to react to gravity. And, of course, there's no gravity in space, so plants don't know how to put down root systems. And then there's the yield. Obviously, you want a yield every 30 days, ideally, or every 60 days. And sometimes these plants, you know, they have a good yield, sometimes they don't. And so it's a lot of hit and miss. And like I say, you really have to increase the closure of the biomass before you get to the – you don't need full system closure, but you need about a 98% system closure. And right now we're sitting at about 93% system closure. So we have a way to go before we go to Mars.
One of the things that I hear a lot on the space show has to do with the space settlement efforts and pushing space settlement forward. As a policy and technology, and I've talked to space architects and, you know, people involved with it, but they don't know very much about the medical and really and truly the life support side. So talk about space settlement, because that is a segment of the industry that interests a whole lot of people. What's needed for that, and are we even close to that?
Yeah, we're getting close. Like I say, they've figured out how to build a habitat, and it's all to do with 3D printing. I mean, you send 3D printers to the moon, and they start 3D printing the base. When they've finished 3D printing the base, then they cover it with regolith to a depth of about 5 feet, because you need to protect the astronauts from radiation. That's a big mission killer. So it's not too bad on a surface. Once you're on the planetary surface, you just keep on piling the regolith onto the base until you have it deep enough to protect the astronauts. But it's during the transit that's difficult. But getting back to the base, in terms of life support systems, for a moon, for a moon mission. We have the technology to do that, even for a quite long duration mission, because you can have resupply from Earth. It's when you go further afield to Mars, that's when it becomes a problem, because you really can't get resupply where you can, but it takes, you're waiting for those 26-month launch windows to take place, and you might be in for a bit of a wait if you can't make your own food and also to generate all the consumables. So everything on the ISS is basically geared towards developing technology for future life support, and also not just life support, but technologies to enable a mission to Mars to occur. And a lot of that technology is directed towards, first of all, recycling consumables, recovering consumables, and then recycling those consumables. They need to be able to generate oxygen, you need to be able to recover oxygen from the water. A good example is the urine processing facility, or the urine processing assembly that's been up there for a long, long time. And that is the main way that they recover water on the space station, and it operates at about 75% efficiency. And anybody with an internet connection can go online and go to ISSlive.com, and you go to the life support system, and it will tell you how much urine has been processed, how much water has been recovered, how much oxygen has been generated. And there are good numbers. I mean, it's the oxygen generating assembly, for example, that typically generates around 2.7 kilograms of oxygen per day. Now, what does that mean? Every astronaut per day uses 840 grams of oxygen. And so if you're generating 2.7, 2.6 kilograms of oxygen per day, you're pretty close to providing all the oxygen requirements for the United States orbital segment, because that's where four astronauts live. And then, but having said that, you can have a great generating assembly or great recovery system, but if they require lots and lots of maintenance, that's to say if they're very maintenance intensive or if they break down a lot, then that's an aspect of the technology that you have to work on. And if you read Scott Kelly's book, he mentioned the bane of an astronaut's existence on the space station when it comes to life support systems is a carbon dioxide removal assembly, because that's the toughest job, or one of the toughest jobs of a life support system, is getting rid of carbon dioxide. It's very, very tough for these systems to do that. So right now we're breathing 0.03% carbon dioxide. On a good day on the space station, when everything's working well, they're breathing 1.2%. 30 times as much as what we're doing, which is why they can't really have more crew on board, because the carbon dioxide concentration would increase. That's another technology gap, is getting rid of carbon dioxide. And they're making progress all the time. The European Space Agency threw up a rack in 2018 that not only scrubs more carbon dioxide, but it also recovers oxygen from the carbon dioxide to be reused again. But like I say, it takes time. It's basically an aggregation of marginal gains approach, making lots and lots of small gains, and all those small gains add up to a measurable gain.
Your first email question for the day is from Lane, and this is spelled L-A-I-N-E. And I apologize, Lane. I don't know if that's a he or a she name, so I'm not trying to be offensive. But Lane would like to know, and says part of space settlement is actually having real villages, towns, or colonies, or something of that order. So what's the progress on possibly children in space, having children in space, or is there no progress?
Oh, no, there's progress. So on the space station, they have what's called an animal enclosure module, the AEM. And it's a little rack that they have. I've forgotten which module it's in, but it's a little rack, and it houses about half a dozen rats at any one time. And they have their own little life support system, and they use these rats for all sorts of tests. So some of the tests are to investigate bone loss, because they can't do any in-flight bone loss measurements in space. They can only do it in pre-flight and post-flight. And other tests they do on these rats are from, reproduction tests as well. And so they get an idea of how the reproductive cycle is affected by microgravity, because that would be that's something you really need to know before you start populating a planet with a reduced gravity. You need to be able to see what the effect is on all the systems, especially the cardiovascular system, and especially the bone system, the skeletal system, because the body adapts to any environment that you put it in, and we see this in spaceflight. So as soon as you put the body, and I'll just explain one system. So as soon as you put an astronaut in space, you have all these sensors in the body, pressure sensors and load sensors and all sorts of sensors. And as soon as you go into space, the body detects an absence of load because you're not walking around. You're just using your upper body to maneuver yourself around the space station. And so the body says, right, well, we don't need our bones to be as strong, so we'll stop this process of bone remodeling. And we'll tell the osteoblasts, which are these bone cells that build up the bone, we'll tell them to stop working as hard, and we'll tell the osteoclasts that break down the bone to work extra hard to get rid of the bone. And that's what happens. And astronauts lose 1 to 1.2% of their bone mass every single month. That's 10 times the rate at which somebody with osteoporosis loses bone. And, of course, at the end of 6 months, they've lost about 7 or 8% of their total bone mass. Now, you imagine having given birth to somebody in a reduced gravity environment, that's exactly what's going to happen, is that the newborn baby, their systems are going to react to the reduced gravity environment. So their bones will not be as strong. They'll be strong enough to deal with the reduced gravity. What happens if the baby who is born on Mars, when they grow up, they want to come back to Earth? Their bones are not going to be strong enough.
Do we know that for a fact, or that's a theory?
That's
a good theory.
Probably a little bit stronger than a theory, because we see how bodies adapt in zero-G. We've seen that for a long, long time now. We haven't seen it, obviously, in humans, but we can infer that from what we've seen in animal studies.
Do we know that you could have a kid born in space and it would be born okay?
It would be born okay, but it would be adapted to the environment. And like I say, the longer, say for example, a child was born on Mars and it lived to age 15, 16, 17, and it decided to come back to Earth, the fracture risk would be extreme if it was to come back to Earth, because the skeletal system wouldn't be developed to deal with the load here on Earth.
Maybe they'd have genetic engineering by then and could make the bones stronger.
Well, that's why I wear my replicant T-shirt to class sometimes, and then when I talk about this, I just point to my T-shirt and say, look, this is one solution. This is why they developed replicants for Blade Runner, to deal with the problems baseline humans couldn't deal with.
What's on your T-shirt?
It just says replicant, which is, Blade Runner, right?
Right, uh-huh.
So I have a T-shirt with replicant on it.
So where does that put space settlement on the timeline from your perspective and your understanding of life support and things? Is it near-term plausible, desirable, risky? How do you assess space settlement?
It's super risky. I mean, we all know that SpaceX is probably going to get there sooner rather than later. I've put money on them doing that. But you have to realize it's a super risky proposition. I mean, all the unknowns. I mean, EDL, engine descent and landing, that's just one. Just the life support system, protecting them from radiation. I mean, the first mission is a survival mission, pure and simple. That's it. Afterwards, if they're successful, then yes, you can start ferrying more people there. And sooner or later, somebody is going to give birth to somebody on Mars. That's going to happen. But long before that happens, you really got a duty to investigate this a little bit more than we have, so you have a good idea of what may happen to those babies born.
Is our space settlement research moving along, or is it kind of stymied? Can you do it without even being in space?
No, you can do so much with modeling, but I show my students, it's actually in the textbook, the interrelationship of all the systems. So it's not, the body is a complex series of systems, and they all overlap and affect each other to some degree. And that's the reason why you have to do on-site testing, that's to say in-space testing and research. And the ISS does a great job. I mean, at any one time, it has 200 experiments running live, and a lot of those are life support experiments. And NASA is very methodical in its approach. And they say, we're going to take our time. We're only going to go to Mars when we're good and ready. And that good and ready timeline is around 2038, 2039, around that sort of timeline. Where SpaceX is obviously, as we know, much more gung-ho, because they're not limited by the rules and regulations of a government-funded entity. All they need to do is to apply to the FAA for the launch and reentry license, and once they get that approved, they can do anything, pretty much.
Eric, is there one life support human factors risk that stands out as the granddaddy of all risk to you, or do you sort of classify five or six of them as being equal, and what would they be? I'm trying to think what you think our biggest challenge is for our biggest risk.
Yeah, so the mission killers, as they're sometimes called, for a trip to Mars. So we're not talking about living on Mars now. We're talking about the trip to and the trip back from Mars. It's got to be radiation and then bone loss, because here on Earth, just to give those who are listening, just to give a metric or a comparative metric, you're exposed to 2 millisieverts of radiation in a year. 6 months on station, you're exposed to 80 millisieverts per year. Sorry, 80 millisieverts in 6 months, I should say. That's a lot more, but still, it's not too bad. But once you go to Mars, you're exposed to 600, around between 400 and 600 on the way there, and about 400 to 600 on the way back. That's a huge amount of radiation that you're exposed to. And it's a different type of radiation, because in low Earth orbit, at the orbit of the International Space Station, which orbits at 250 miles altitude, you're protected by the atmosphere, because it's only in the fourth layer of the atmosphere, in the thermosphere. Above the thermosphere, you've got another layer of the atmosphere called the exosphere. Plus, you've got the magnetic belts, the Earth's magnetic belts to protect you as well. But once you've entered deep space, then you're exposed to a lot more galactic cosmic radiation. And we know from the Apollo astronauts that's bad. 40% of the astronauts who came back from Apollo had cataracts. That's radiation-induced cataracts within 5 years of coming back. And they really, really need to protect the astronauts better from radiation. And then there's the bone loss. So if you're losing 8% of your bone mass in 6 months, that's how much you'd lose on the way to Mars, and you lose another 7 or 8% on the way back, the chances are you would never recover that bone mass. Now, even astronauts know this, and even knowing this, you have astronauts lined up outside the door of the astronaut office to volunteer for a mission to Mars. But NASA has a duty and care for its astronauts, for the health of its astronauts, because it's a government-funded agency. SpaceX doesn't. It's not a government-funded agency. They can get away with this, and again, it'll be interesting to see, because the first people who go there will be guinea pigs to a large degree. And it'll be interesting to see how they cope when they come back with, you know, a 15% loss of their bone mass, because the chances are they would never recover that.
You know, to kind of put this in context, and I almost am hesitant to do this because I'm going to reveal some personal medical issues, but I'm one of those guys who has a 2-year recall on a bone density testing, a DEXA scan. And this all started when I had my dog attack and took some heavy injuries when the dog attacked me and I fell. And those of you that were listening to the show back then probably know about that. So I'm losing bone mass. So some of this is with age, and who the hell knows what some of it is. But if I lose maybe 1% of bone mass, it raises my chances for a serious fracture if I just fell in normal course of life to like 25% and 30%.
That's
so,
right, yeah.
And so when you talk about how much bone mass they're losing in space, and someone says, well, 8%, 10%, that's not that much. When you understand what it means to, you know, having damage in a fall. I'm not talking about falling from 10 feet. I'm talking about maybe you trip over a dog toy in the living room floor and you take a header. You can have some pretty serious injuries with just a fraction of that kind of bone loss. So it's a big deal. And
it is.
Even for people that are younger than me, it's a big deal.
Yeah, so to give the listeners some more insight into this, so just to give some more comparative metrics and some numbers. So that 7% of bone loss that you have lost as an astronaut after 6 months on station equates to a 2- to 3-fold increase in fracture risk. Now, NASA and any agency will always plan for the worst-case scenario. You don't plan for you obviously plan for the best-case scenario, but you also plan for the worst-case scenario.
Right, of course, yeah.
And so you imagine the first astronaut on Mars taking that step off the ladder and then bouncing onto the surface and their femur snaps. That's an appalling mission scenario for you to deal with.
Yeah, probably won't. I doubt that it would even heal very well on Mars.
Well, you have a crew of four, and now you've taken two out of the loop, three out of the loop, because you have two astronauts who have to work 24/7 to look after the injured astronaut. Plus, we know from these animal models that we mentioned before with the rats, because they intentionally break the rats' bones to see how well they heal. And, of course, because it's a reduced gravity environment, the bone takes longer to heal. And it doesn't heal as well. It heals to be able to deal with the gravitational force on Mars, which is one-third that of Earth. So the bones don't heal as strong. Secondly, anybody who's broken a bone, and this is a question I ask all my students when we get to this subject, how many of you have broken a long bone? And usually, invariably, one or two hands will go up. And every once in a while, somebody will mention external fixation, because external fixation, that's when you have those rods outside of your bone holding the bone in place. That's not standard, but it's a pretty routine way of holding the bone in place. You don't have that in the medical kit on an interplanetary spacecraft. Now, we know astronauts are a resourceful lot, and they could probably get by, but still you have the problems with if infection. You're on a planetary surface. What happens if you get the soil inside the spacecraft? Now you've got contamination from a foreign body. You have that to deal with as well. So it's a really, really bad mission scenario when you have broken bones on a planet, interplanetary surface with no resupply. So that's, like I say, you always hope for the best and plan for the worst.
That's
a very bad day.
When you come back, don't you regain some of that lost bone mass?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, because I was going to mention that. So if you're wondering how long it takes for the bones to, for the astronauts to regain their bone, it's 3 to 5 years. That's the average. But that's the average. Some astronauts regain bone quicker. I'll give you an example of somebody who takes longer. Thomas Reiter, he was a European Space Agency astronaut who flew for 6 months in 1995. 10 years later, he had not recovered the bone that he had lost in that mission. So there's a big variation, and the reason I mention this is because when it comes to astronaut selection, maybe it makes more sense to only select those best medically qualified astronauts, because we know some astronauts, as I mentioned before, regain bone quicker. Some astronauts don't lose as much bone as other astronauts. There are some astronauts who are more radiation resistant. They think they've found a gene now that indicates how radiation resistant you are. So wouldn't it make sense to select these astronauts who have all these special capabilities in terms of resisting bone loss and resisting radiation?
You have a caller waiting patiently to talk to you. Hi, caller. Good morning, and or I should say good afternoon, and welcome to the Space Show.
This is Marshall, and my question is, do we have to have a artificial gravity space station, and for how long before we can go to Mars?
No, we don't. And I wrote about this in the Chapter 9, which is Future Life Support Concepts. So when you read these articles in Popular Science Magazine and Wired and all these other popular science magazines, and they talk about artificial gravity and saying, oh, artificial gravity can help us get to Mars. The way these articles are sometimes written leads you to believe that we have the technology, but we don't. And we started talking about artificial gravity in 1929 when Hermann Nordung, who's a famous Slovenian scientist, published an article, the first scientific article about artificial gravity. And now, 100 years later, we're nowhere close to developing artificial gravity because we missed the boat. So back in 2003, we built the centrifuge accommodations module for the International Space Station. It was supposed to be flown on the ISS. But then Columbia happened, and so we had to cancel the space shuttle program, and we had to cut costs. And the centrifuge accommodations module, which was due to be flown on the space station to research artificial gravity, has been collecting dust for the last 17 years in a parking lot in Tsukuba, Japan. So for the last 17 years... we haven't been able to do any artificial gravity research except for limited studies on Earth. And most studies really aren't coordinated. We've got a short radius centrifuge at Wiley and Johnson Space Center. And when I was at the ISS R&D conference 3 years ago, I asked them about the short radius centrifuge. And I said, look, are you still using this to do the artificial gravity research? And they just shook their head. No, we haven't been using it for a while. There's another one in DLR in Germany, German Space Agency. They do testing every once in a while. And so we have a long way to go, and people think, well, why is it so difficult? Because surely artificial gravity would solve so many problems. And it would, because if you can create artificial gravity, you don't have to worry as much about the bone loss, you don't have to worry as much about the muscle atrophy. But do doing this in reality is very, very difficult, because once you start spinning people, you upset the balance system in the inner ear.
But Eric, they talk about how easy it is to have tethers and use tethers on the space flight going to Mars, and it's talked about and presented in such a way that it's absolutely no big deal. I hear it all the time with both guests and callers on the space show.
You do, but if it's so simple, why hasn't it been done?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a TR level too, maybe.
I listened to Musk on his Mars Society talk from a week ago, maybe 10 days ago. And, you know, he's talking about going to Mars, and, you know, he thinks maybe some demo flights will be 2024 or maybe 2022. He's really trying to push the envelope. But when he talks about this, he never mentions if he's going to do any artificial gravity going to Mars. He doesn't mention life support at all anyway, at least not that I've ever heard. So I don't know if Musk plans to take people to Mars and what the life support would be like, or if there will be artificial gravity or whatever. You may be closer to that because you've written books about SpaceX. But I don't hear any of this talked about by him. And he's got the closest timeline that may be plausible. Maybe that's a stretch. I don't know. Far closer than any national space agency.
Well, he's not planning on artificial gravity. Just before I get to the Starship life support, I'll just explain. There are two types. The two ways you can generate artificial gravity on a spacecraft. One is to have a short radius centrifuge. So that's inside the module. And it's a little centrifuge that spins round and round and round, and there's one or two crew that go on it at maybe for an hour or 2 or 3 hours a day. That's more likely. We're more likely to see that sooner rather than later, because that's what we've been doing here on Earth, is testing short radius centrifuges. What you saw in the Martian, which is the more elegant approach taken by Andy Weir, was to actually spin the spacecraft around a central point, the habitat. That's a more elegant approach, and that gets rid of a lot of the problems, such as affecting the balance system in the ear, because once you start spinning on a short radius centrifuge, you get what's called a Coriolis effect. So imagine spinning around quite quickly for 2 hours or 3 hours at a time. Once you stop, your head is still spinning. And so this becomes an operational problem, because, first of all, you're only going to have one short radius centrifuge on the spacecraft. You have maybe 4 or 6 crew, all of who have to use that short radius centrifuge for 2, 3, 4 hours, and then you have to set aside maybe 2 or 3 hours per crew member to basically get back to normal, because they're going to be so discombobulated, because their head is going to be spinning so violently after going round and round and round for so many hours. So there are lots and lots of problems. Some people adjust quite quickly, some people don't. You have to determine what the optimal spin-up rate is, what the offset rate is. Is 2G for half an hour better than 1G for 2 hours? I mean, there are all sorts of permutations that you have to test. And, of course, because there are so few short-radius centrifuges, it takes a long time to sort through all those permutations, because ideally you want to test at least 50 or 60 people of varying ages and various, you know, cardiovascular, sorry, people have different health levels. And like I say, it all takes time. And ultimately, you really do need to test that system in space. And we haven't done that yet.
So you're basically saying ISS is basically going to be just the one space station, and we probably won't develop another space station for artificial gravity before people get to Mars?
Well, the space station, its intended lifespan was 2024, and the consortium, you know, as you know, it's a whole group of countries who are involved in the space station, they approved to extend its life to 2028. So they've got about another 8 years to do some more testing for artificial gravity. But like I say, without that artificial gravity module, there's only so much they can do. So maybe there are other modules planning to be flown, like Axiom. I'm not sure if they're taking an artificial or short, not sure if they're taking a short radius centrifuge. But as far as I know, there are no plans to fly or do any artificial gravity testing in the next few years in space.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully somebody will clear the deck and get it done. I don't want to see a space shuttle to SpaceX, you know, relying on the Russians or somebody else, kind of delay? Because that's the thing I really worry about, is nobody addresses the issue until it becomes critical and nobody can do anything.
Well, if you go to the NASA website, for their Mars, they have a Mars dedicated website, and you can see that their plan is a long plan, a strategic plan and a tactical plan for how they're going to get to Mars. And there's a whole page or series of pages dedicated to life support systems. Basically, they list the what are called criticality gaps, and the higher the number, the bigger the criticality. And the highest criticality is for carbon dioxide removal. Nowhere on those pages is artificial gravity mentioned, because it's just too tough a nut to crack. And so when NASA finally goes to Mars at the end of the 2030s, hopefully, they'll just be going in a traditional spacecraft called the Orion with a service module strapped on the back, and that's it.
How is Musk going to go to Mars in a Dragon or whatever, or a Starship?
Well, he's going to take his Starship, isn't he? And he's taking the Battlestar Galactica approach.
Sounds like I've had enough fun for today. Until next time.
Thank you, Marshall. Listeners, you can call us, and we're going to do our break in a few minutes, and then we're going to talk about terminal reality. But our phone number is 866-687-7223. Email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. What is the life support plan on Starship? You've been writing books on SpaceX, and you told me you've got another one in the works, a second edition. What do you see about Starship?
Well, you go to the conferences like the International Astronautical Congress, and you try and find bits of information about this there. But there are papers published, and it was also presented at IAC last year, about the Crew Dragon life support system.
Uh-huh.
That sort of gives you an insight into what they may be doing for Starship. And there's nothing special about the life support system on Crew Dragon. I mean, they're using the latest technology for recycling and recovering consumables. It's all very lightweight and compact, so it's a little bit more lightweight and compact, as you'd imagine, than the ISS systems, because you don't have to support the crew for as long. They only have to support the crew for, a few weeks at the most. But for the Starship, yeah, that's tough. I mean, the space station has a habitable volume of 931 cubic meters, which is about the same as a five-bedroom house. And I can't remember what the habitable volume of the Starship is, but I think it's smaller than the space station. Now, how on earth are you going to scrub carbon dioxide from 100 people? I just do not know. There is no technology I'm aware of that can do that, even on submarines. I mean, there is some technology now that's sort of making its way from submarines to spacecraft, but still, to scrub that amount of carbon dioxide is a big, big ask.
How do they do it on a submarine?
Well, it's a different system that they use on submarines, and it's more of an engineering question, really, for that. But it's basically using, to try and figure out the best way to explain this, but let's see. I'm trying to think what the term is now. I've gotten the term for the, there's a term for what they use in the submarines. I've just forgotten it. Just had a memory. What is it? It'll come to me in a moment. All right, so, yeah, thirsty walls. That's it. So it's the thirsty walls concept. That's what's used in submarines. And the scrubbing technology is used on submarines. They're basically, let's see, I'm trying to think. Because they can scrub carbon dioxide for, obviously, the crew of a submarine, but it's more of a liquid-based capture system. That's the difference. And so liquid-based capture systems are more compact, more power efficient, and more reliable. And the reason they can't use these liquid-based capture systems on a space station is because they require this special gas-permeable membrane. And these gas-permeable membranes don't work as effectively in space as they do on submarines, because they have what are called slow kinetics. They don't work as quickly. And if anything that scrubs carbon dioxide doesn't work as quickly as it needs to do, then you're going to have carbon dioxide poisoning. Having said that, these liquid space systems are now being developed to work on spacecraft better because they have developed what are called faster kinetics, basically faster scrubbing systems. So that may be possible. We may be able to scale up a submarine carbon dioxide removal system to work on a spacecraft. That's possible.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Doug from Redlands, California.
Go for it.
Yeah. Hey, Eric. So help me understand. We've had probably more than 100 people on the International Space Station for more than, you know, for like 6 months, about 6 months, similar to the duration of a trip to Mars. Yet, as far as I know, nobody has fractured their femur when they've returned to Earth. How confident are you that, in fact, people are going to fracture their femur when they step out on Mars?
I think it's very, very unlikely. I mean, here on Earth, when astronauts come back, they go to the strength and rehabilitation coaches. And what they do, they develop a personalized exercise plan to help those astronauts recover their muscle because they've lost about 20 to 25% of their muscle and also recover their bone. When they're on the surface of Mars, then, again, you plan for the best. I mean, it's very unlikely. But, again, NASA is very good at planning for worst-case scenarios, and that's what you have to plan for. So I think it's very unlikely. I mean, there is a percentage. I mean, I've seen this listed in an article somewhere, and it's in the decimal points in terms of the risk of this happening. But if it was to happen, then you have to have a plan of action. And depending on which bone was broken, if it's a long bone, that's a worst-case scenario because that's a load-bearing bone, and that can cause lots of problems in terms of recovery and also the bone healing. It'll obviously take longer for the bone to heal. The risk is very small. But it's just a case you still have to plan for that risk.
So the 2 out of 6 people with fractures, that's not a realistic scenario. You weren't advocating that as a realistic scenario?
So what I was saying, if you were to have an astronaut who broke a bone and you had a crew of 4, then you've lost 3 of the crew. Because 2 of the other crew then have to look after that other crew member because it's a pretty serious business looking after somebody with a fracture of the femur or a long bone fracture. And so operationally, that's a big impact on the mission. Obviously, it wouldn't be 3 people out of the loop for several weeks, but certainly in the first few days following the incident, you have those 3 crew members pretty much out of the loop.
Now, you mentioned the 7% bone mineral density reduction on a 6-month mission. Is that taking into account the load-bearing exercise protocols that they are now doing on ISS? Are they still having the same level of bone mineral density loss?
Yes. If you go back to Skylab, when they were just finding out about this, the Skylab astronauts were losing about 2.5 to 3.2% during the longest mission, which was 84 days. But now with better protocols, with 2 hours of exercise, almost 2 hours of exercise, it's down to 1 to 1.2% per month. That's how much they're losing right now with the best protocols. And people often ask, well, why don't they just exercise more? The reason they can't exercise more is because you increase the carbon dioxide concentration on the space station, and then you put an extra burden on the life support system to try and get rid of that extra carbon dioxide. Plus, astronauts are quite busy. They have other things they have to do. And there's a limitation on the use of the exercise equipment because you've got 4 crew in the United States orbital segment, each of whom have to do 2 hours of exercise. And so that plays into the planning as well.
So if you did do tether and spin up, I mean, we know the physics of it. It's the principle of equivalency. If you had a tether that's long enough, the Coriolis effects or the effects on the neurovestibular system could be fairly small. So I believe that the reason why we haven't done it is not because it's so hard, but because we haven't needed to do it, because we haven't been doing long-duration travel to Mars. And so I think as we approach the time in which we are about to go to Mars, then I think there will be a focusing of attention and these things will be done. And I think we will get that we expect based on physics. Your thoughts?
Well, you're right. I mean, NASA has developed these concepts. NASA has an institute called the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts, NIAC. And back in 2007, an engineer called Kent Houston, J-O-O-S-T-N, developed what's called the fire baton concept, which is the one that you explained exactly just now with a tether to the habitat. And very, very elegant. I mean, these papers were published, and just a beautiful design. But if you look at the hardware that NASA is using right now for their plan to go to Mars, the first Mars mission, it's Orion, the Orion spacecraft, and a service module. That's what they're planning on using for the first Mars mission. So I think during the development time of the life support systems and all the other technologies leading to the first Mars mission, then I think you're going to see, as you said, an increase in artificial gravity research. But the actual spacecraft that actually goes for that takes the first mission is probably going to be a standard spacecraft, because that's the one that NASA has developed for that particular mission.
Well, I think SpaceX is going to beat NASA to Mars. I think a lot of us are feeling that way nowadays. Okay, well, thank you for asking my questions. I appreciate it.
Doug, you followed this real closely. Do you have any insights as to SpaceX and life support on Starship?
The reason why I think you have not heard anything about life support is because we're not there yet. I mean, they're talking about propulsion and, you know, aero surfaces, et cetera. So with time that they're going to go ahead and address it. They do have substantial experience with Crew Dragon, and as the time approaches, especially if there's a partnership with NASA, then all sorts of information gained from the station, as well as companies like the one there in Tucson, what's it called, Paragon?
Paragon, uh-huh.
Yeah. But, you know, these things will come together at the time that they're needed. That's my view.
What do you think they'll do about artificial gravity, anything?
I believe, Elon, you know, very few people have asked Elon about that, but I think Elon's view is the time frame is too short to worry about it, meaning going to Mars. Now, he's not going for, you know, flag and footprint. People go there to stay. So there's not the microgravity on the return trip, but I have not heard anything about artificial gravity on the surface of Mars.
Okay. Thank you.
David, I have a question for you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Right. So to answer these questions, can you please invite Jason Silverman, Andrew Irby, and Theodore Adjutant to your show, because they are the senior SpaceX development engineers for life support for SpaceX. They will be able to answer all those questions.
Okay, so let me tell you what will happen. They will not come on the show. So public appearances are tightly, tightly controlled by SpaceX, and actually I don't blame them for doing it. I have tried to get not them, but others on the show before, and the clearances are not given. They're as tight as it is with some people at NASA. It's really hard to get some people at NASA on the program, too. So
those are interested in life support for SpaceX.
But I can certainly try, but can you send me an email with their names and spelling?
Yeah, so it's Doug, right, who's on the call right now?
Well, you're still on the call with me. Doug got off the line.
Okay, because I'll give you the names again. So it's Jason Silverman. If you punch these into Google, you'll come up with the paper that actually talks about the development of the Crew Dragon life support.
Okay.
It'll give you an insight into how they're going to scale up these technologies for the Starship. So it's Jason Silverman. He's the senior Dragon development engineer.
Okay.
Andrew Irby, I-R-B-Y.
Hold on.
The life support engineer. And then it's Theodore Egerton, A-G-E-R-T-O-N. And he's the senior life support engineer. He's probably the guy who you could extend an invitation to. But, of course, as you said,
I will make the effort and keep my fingers crossed and we'll see what happens.
So they published a paper, and it's available online, and it talks in a lot of detail about all the subsystems on the Crew Dragon. And you're reading through the paper, and you can see, well, these are all systems they're going to scale up for Starship, basically.
Okay. With that, Eric, we're almost at the top of the hour. I'm going to take a short pause and talk about our sponsors for a minute, and then when we come back, we can switch over to Terminal Reality, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So, listeners, we do have sponsors, and they're great. We would not be doing the program without them. So remember, they do get the banner ad going across the homepage. They can change that whenever they want. And on the longer segmented programs, I read their messages. So Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they're a leading security global company, innovative systems, product solutions, government and the private sector, and they do work undersea to outer space and cyberspace. Now, the Space Foundation has started something anew, and let me see if I can find the information I have about it, it's a little bit different. So they have started Space Symposium 365, and you can find out about this on their website, spacefoundation.org. Year-round programming featuring space leaders, insight, and connections. So you can find out more about it, and I'm working to get more information about their new program as well. But it's called Space Symposium 365 programs. They're going to have a lot of them. And they've got some planned, there's a big program coming up for October 28th, one for October 27th, one for October 26th. So go check it out. And as I get more information, I will be happy to keep sharing it with you. But it sounds to me like a very exciting way to have some new digital formatting that's pretty cool. Astrox Corporation sponsors us, and they've been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than three decades. Visit them at astrox.com. You can get a lot more information. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, which is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have multiple events, but again, this year they're all virtual. But if you go to AIAA, you will find out all of their information, and you can even join AIAA without being an engineer. You don't have to be an engineer. So again, check it all out, AIAA.org. Moonward sponsors us. And what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions on technical and economic merit? Moonwards is building this town, a digital vision of it, where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to the events. Visit moonwards.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development. Help us see the world, a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And I misread that, but... Kim has been tweeting out a lot of their new designs and things, so I suggest you follow Moonwards on Twitter. She's been putting out a lot of really exciting images, so check that out, everybody. Celestis sponsors us, and they are still the group to go to for memorial space flights with either cremated remains, or you can use DNA if you don't cremate. You can include your DNA with that of your loved one. You can jointly make the flight. So they have orbital, suborbital, and their lunar mission coming up. So check them out at Celestis.com. And I think they have some flights scheduled for right around the corner, although I know scheduling for 2020 has been hard because of the pandemic. The National Space Society sponsors us. And again, they do... ISDC, they talk a lot about and have papers published on space settlement, space solar power. So it is space.nss.org. ISDC 2021 will be a combination of what would have been ISDC 2020. It's supposed to be in Los Angeles. Stay tuned on if that's going to be in Los Angeles and take place. Finally, we have the Integrated Space Plan as a sponsor, the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own copy of the space plan. It comes in a couple of sizes, but it's inspiring. You can frame it. You can use it as a teaching tool for family members or if you're a teacher for your classes. So check it all out, thespaceplan.com. And we're into part two. Our guest is Eric Seathouse. And Eric, you don't typically do science fiction. What happened?
Well, because I have so many people ask me or suggest that I write a science fiction novel, so I got fed up of that and decided to write one, so I'd actually say yes, I've written one.
So it's listed on Amazon, I saw. It's called Terminal Reality, listener. You want to tell us the storyline, or I can read what I know the storyline is from writing. But the book is available in different formats, so introduce us to it.
Yeah, so it's what you would call hard science fiction. I have to say it applies current technologies and sort of over the horizon technologies, but technologies that we can imagine are accessible. And it's basically just a group of misfits on a starship, basically trying to escape Earth because Earth hasn't got much longer to go before it's uninhabitable. And two of the crew are engineered, so basically a little bit like replicants, but not quite the same. They're basically bioengineered or genetically engineered humans. And it's just going through their various adventures, going through wormholes and encountering aliens and suffering through hibernation, long hibernations, to try and get to where they're going. Things break down. So actually lots of things break down. So their antimatter harvester breaks down, their life support system breaks down, all sorts of things break down because that's what happens in space. Things break down and they have to troubleshoot and deal with all sorts of hurdles along the way to their destination, which is the a new habitable world, which is where they're going to kickstart the human race using this special technology.
How far away is this habitable world?
Oh, I think it's about... I can't remember now, actually. I think it's about 30 light years.
What are they doing? Are they hibernating? What did you use to get them out there that far over however long that would take?
Yes, I used hibernation, and that's what starts the that's the first chapter is when the hibernation system breaks down, and so they have to come out of hibernation. And hibernation breaks down later on. It's been a while since I wrote this book. No, it's the they get a beacon. They respond to a beacon of a stranded spaceship, and so they make their way to the stranded spaceship, and then things go south from there, basically.
What's their propulsion for interstellar travel?
They're using antimatter, and they have an antimatter harvester to deal with that. So they can get up to about 50% light speed using the antimatter propulsion.
So, sort of plausible, but way not there yet, correct?
Not by a long way. Not for that technology.
I've been hearing people talk on antimatter propulsion at various conferences, so they're thinking about it at least today.
Yeah, no, the closest technology we have to for a faster propulsion system is going to be Vasimir, and that's hopefully going to happen in the next few years. I mean, Franklin's been working on it for 40 years now, and I think they're very close to having it demonstrated on the ISS because they have an agreement, a Space Act agreement with NASA to do that.
When he was on the show with you, they were just starting this 100-hour test, I recall.
Yeah, so. I haven't heard anything about that recently. I think they had another technological hurdle. Because that's once they've completed that test, because NASA's going to be there in attendance to watch the test, once they've completed that test, that's the last thing they need to do before they actually fly up a scalable test article to the space station, and they're going to use it to do orbital reboost.
So they haven't finished that 100-hour test yet?
Not as far as I know. No, it's a shame because they were right on the threshold of that when we talked last.
But he's been working on that for at least 10 years, right?
Well, he's been working on the system for 40 years.
Yeah. A long time.
Yeah, with his group at Astra.
Who are your characters in Terminal Reality? I mean, you've only got two humans on the crew, right?
We've got four humans, two bioengineered synthetics, as I call them. We've got a little robotic assistant called Larry, and then we've got a cat called Strife.
So you've
also
got
genetically engineered.
Do they encounter the problems that you talk about, for example, in your life support textbook? I mean, this is obviously, if you're going interstellar, it's a whole different world. But what are some of the kinds of challenges that they face and that equipment breaks down and they have to repair it somehow?
Well, the hibernation system. So people think that's science fiction, but we have a company called Spaceworks International in Atlanta. They've been investigating this for years, thanks to a multi-million-dollar grant from NASA. And you think it's science fiction, but this is actually a procedure that's been used in medicine and is used in medicine routinely. It's called therapeutic hypothermia. And so it's not quite the hibernation that you see in the film Alien or the film Aliens. But if you reduce the body temperature by a certain amount, you can actually induce a hibernated state in humans. And what they do in medicine, it's for those people who are very severely injured, who maybe not up to being, maybe can't withstand surgery. They put them in this hibernated state until they've recovered to a level where they can actually sustain or tolerate surgery. And basically, what SpaceWorks did, they applied this to maybe future astronauts. So their system of hibernation is therapeutic hypothermia. But in the novel, in the science fiction novel, it's hibernation has evolved a little bit beyond that, and you can actually put astronauts to sleep for years at a time. But, of course, it's part of a life support system, and life support systems break down, and that's what happens in the novel. They have to repair the life support system. Other parts of the life support system is the thermal humidity control system, so there's a lot of leaking of pipes, and they have to fix that. And, it's basically... life in space, things break down. A lot of what the astronauts do up there on the space station is do routine maintenance tasks and repair tasks. That's a lot of what they do.
You have a note from Brittany in Tucson, Arizona. And Brittany says, if there are only four humans plus various forms of humans or clones or something like that, what do they expect to do or find on the new world that they're heading from? Are there other humans going in other spaceships, or is this it for the human race?
Well, this is it. So when they're woken up in hibernation because of this beacon, they obviously have all the news that's been accumulating for the last X number of years while they've been asleep. And part of that news is that the human race has been taken out by a nanoplague. So basically, these are the last humans alive. And... two of the four humans don't last long, so you're basically down to two humans and two synthetics after a while, and you're sort of trying to figure out, okay, who's going to survive? And one argument is that maybe, you know, baseline humans aren't designed for long-duration spaceflight. That's one of the themes that is developed in the novel. And you're sort of playing a guessing game as you're reading it. Okay, well, which are the strongest, the humans or the synthetic humans? Who's going to survive this? Because not all of them are going to survive. And in terms of kickstarting the human race, what they have with them are these briefcases inside which are these artificial wombs. So basically they just program this system to actually generate artificial fetuses, and then the fetuses grow in this lab, basically. So there's no natural childbirth, as it were.
Like test tube babies.
Exactly,
sort of.
Yeah. There you go.
I guess you don't want to tell what happens, but is there a good chance the human race somehow prevails?
Well, I don't want to give any too much spoiler alert, but let's just say not all of them die.
So this, when did you write? You said you wrote it quite a while ago. When did you actually write this?
Right, so 18 years ago, I was involved in a production company called Unwatchable Productions. So one of the things I wanted to do was always to write a screenplay and make a film. And so I got involved with this production company in Vancouver, And we wrote and filmed two shorts. We actually got semi-finalists in the Anything But Hollywood competition. And after filming the two shorts, they were about 20 minutes long each, I thought, okay, well, let's see if we can write a screenplay, because that's always a challenge, writing a full-length screenplay. And then trying to break into the movie industry is next to impossible unless you know somebody in the movie industry. So the screenplay that I wrote gradually developed into this novel. And so basically it's been on the back burner now for, I started in 2004, so yeah, 16 years.
You have another caller waiting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim. Yeah, I just got a couple of things I wanted to say. I'm going to go kind of back and forth. Right now there is a company that does a lot of work on tethers, and they've actually deployed in space kilometer-long tethers. They would love to get a NASA contract to do work on artificial gravity with tethers, but they haven't. So I'm going in the assumption that this has less to do with technology and more to do with will. They just simply, they're not interested in it.
What's the name of the company?
Tethers Unlimited.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think you've had them on your show before.
Yeah, many times. They were just bought out, I think.
Okay, then they don't exist anymore.
Well, or they may exist. They just maybe a subsidiary of another company. I don't remember the details. Eric's probably familiar with them. Are you familiar with them, Eric?
I've heard of them. I mean, it comes down to money as well. I mean, the perception for a lot of people in the street is that NASA is a manned spaceflight company or agency, but it isn't. That's just part of what they do. They have to do an awful lot with a limited budget that they have, which is $22 billion. And just to put that in perspective, the black budget of the Pentagon is $50 billion, 50, which is more than double the NASA budget. And so the NASA has to do manned spaceflight, it has to do interplanetary science, it has to do all these other things. And so there's, you know, at the end of the day, they have to really stretch that budget. And so it's really about time maybe the commercial sector sort of takes a step forward and says, look, maybe we're interested in developing artificial gravity, because I think that's probably the best and the fastest way we're going to actually do this is to get commercial companies involved.
Tim?
Okay. Well, I was... I misspoke and should have said Congress and not NASA per se, as far as someone's willing to do this project. They're just not funded for it.
The technology's there. Like I say, Kent Houston, just the most beautiful, beautiful, elegant design that he developed way back in 2007. And you think it was a pretty scaled-down version because he obviously wanted to make it not only technologically feasible, but also financially feasible. So all it was really was a small habitat that would house maybe four astronauts on a tether, and then the central point, that would be the propulsion point, and then the tether would rotate around the propulsion module, creating 1G gravity in the habitat.
Well, here's something I just found. This is another article on Nature.com. They're saying that they actually did like a small bioscience experiment where they put rats in a centrifuge for about 35 days and measured their bone loss compared to a control group that was just allowed to free float in the ISS or something like that.
I've done those experiments, but those are what you're talking about is a short radius centrifuge. And we have those one in Wiley at Johnson Space Center, and we have one at the German Space Agency, which is co-located with the European Space Agency in Cologne, Germany. And I think we have one in Canada. I think there's one being developed in Canada. But once you start spinning humans, you have to spin them for quite a while. And when you're on a short radius centrifuge and you start spinning a human, no matter what rate, really, you're interfering with the balance system inside the inner ear, and you get what's called the Coriolis effect. And so when you stop spinning, so imagine being spun for 2 hours on a short radius centrifuge, and you stop spinning. Your head is still spinning because you've been spinning for so long. And you have to take time out to adjust back to feeling normal, basically. That could be 20 minutes, it could be 30 minutes. And so that's where they are right now, is trying to figure out just what is the optimum spin rate and what is the optimum G rate? So do you spin humans for 2 hours at 2G or 3 hours at 1.5G? And then after that spin duration, how long do you have to set aside for them to recover from being spun for so long?
Well, the good thing about the – well, I just want to say that I know that it is a short short-length centrifuge that they put the mice in, but it is a good proof of concept because I know that some people were questioning whether or not the centrifugal – the artificial gravity would even work at all as far as keep maintaining the health of the astronauts. The results were pretty positive for that initial test.
It does. Absolutely. It works. It actually reduces the rate at which bone loss is lost. Absolutely. It's just that you can't ask the rats how do they feel afterwards and what are the long-term effects, because you'd have to go on the centrifuge probably 6 days a week, maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, and it's one thing to do that once or twice a day, or maybe 2 or 3 times a week, but to do it for 6 days a week, for 6 months, that's very different. And you'd have to do a test like that for many, many people to figure out what the long-term effects were. So you'd have to have a number of people who would go and be spun on a centrifuge for maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 6 months, to determine exactly what the long-term effects are. That's the challenge right there. But it's absolutely effective. You're absolutely right.
All right. Oh, one more thing that I was wanting to know: how did that antimatter harvester work? I mean, I don't think there's a lot of antimatter for a Buscar type ramjet to pick up in the interstellar medium, is there?
Well, if you're going very fast, because using antimatter, you can actually get up to about 50% light speed. University of Pennsylvania has done a lot of research on this. Actually, that's where I got a lot of some of the material. And at the end of the book, I actually give my references, because I actually investigated this, so it was written as technically accurate as possible. And if you're going at 50% light speed, you're trapping quite a bit of matter. Apparently, you can trap enough to get the antimatter harvester to work, in theory.
So you just need that initial boost to get speed, and then you can harvest some for... I guess a decelerating, or if you use a mag drag cell, you can use that to decelerate, and then you have antimatter to accelerate when you want to come back to Earth if you want to.
And that's what I had in my science fiction novel. I had a dual propulsion system, and so there's a conventional propulsion system to bring it up to a certain speed, and then the antimatter propulsion system, which had some antimatter stored already to get it up to 50% light speed. Then that took over from the conventional propulsion system.
All right. Oh, one more thing I want to ask you about, and then I'll let you go. There was I know the Soviet Union was working on what's called the pending suit. It was supposed to use mechanical force to simulate the gravity on the astronaut's body, cosmonaut's body. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah, they have one on in Zvezda, which is the module, one of the modules on the Russian orbital segment. So the Russians are very, very traditional when it comes to their countermeasures. So exercise countermeasures, as you know, that helps the astronauts reduce the amount of muscle they lose, reduce the amount of bone mass that they lose. And on the United States orbital segment, so that's to say the Japanese astronauts, the Canadian astronauts, the European and the American astronauts, they use what we would consider conventional exercise countermeasures. So they use the treadmill, they use the advanced resistive exercise device, and those have proven very, very effective at reducing muscle atrophy and bone loss. The Russians, they have a bikeergometer and they have a treadmill, but you try and find a picture of a Russian cosmonaut exercising on the ergometer or treadmill. There aren't many, because they tend to be more traditional. And so they have the penguin suit, but they just explain to the listeners what a penguin suit is. It's basically a full-body suit, and on the arms and the legs, you have these elastic bands. So if you relax, you're curled up into a fetal ball. And so to do any movement at all, whether it's just reaching or just stretching your leg, you have to do that against a force, a resistance. And that's the principle. It's a countermeasure. So basically, you're always having to flex against the resistance or extend against the resistance. And then the other countermeasure that they have is what's called a lower body negative pressure device, which is basically these pants with a pressure cuff around the waist. And what these pants do, they reduce the pressure in the lower body, forcing blood to the lower body. But it's not really exercise, it's just a partial countermeasure. But the penguin suit is used, but it's not nearly as effective as conventional exercise countermeasures that they use in the United States orbital segment.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate your call.
Thanks.
Listeners, there's still time if you would like to call or email us. You can call us using 1-866-687-7223, and you can email us using drspace@thespaceshow.com. You have another caller already. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you, and where are you, please? Hello? We can't hear you. You've got a lousy phone line. Are you there? Okay, I'm sorry. You're not audible. So I don't know if you're what you're using, but please try to call us back with a different phone line or make a change or something. I couldn't understand a word. Did you hear that?
No, I couldn't get that.
Hopefully, caller, you will call us back if you're trying to listen on the speakers on your computer at the same time. Don't do that. That could be part of the problem. I'm not sure. Again, 1-866-687-7223. Are you going to do any more science fiction?
No, probably not. I actually wrote a pilot for a TV show. I just wanted to do that, just if I could do that. And I have a contact who I'm going to send it to, who's involved in TV production, and just see if it's any good, first of all. That's as much as I'm going to do for science fiction.
Okay, let's see if we can get the call this time. Hello, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John. Were you the one calling with a problem?
Was there one? I didn't know. No, I wasn't.
Okay. And it was another caller then.
Well, the course of discussion here has raised an issue in my mind here. You were talking about hibernation ideas and also bone loss due to weightlessness. If you had astronauts in hibernation, would that compensate for the bone loss while they were in hibernation during a long flight?
That's a great question. And there's the challenge. So first of all, when you put astronauts in hibernation, their metabolic rate goes down. So the rate at which you lose muscle and the rate at which you lose bone is less. Having said that, they're still losing muscle, they're still losing bone. So how do you compensate for that? And that's the challenge. So Spaceworks International, which is one of the few companies who's investigating this, they're talking about nanotechnological devices. And this, again, sounds like science fiction, but it's been around for a good 20 years. So these are called vasculoids, these nanotechnological devices, and they're getting more and more mainstream in medicine now. So basically you would inject these nanotechnological devices into the bloodstream, and these nanotechnological devices would go to work to maintain muscle function or muscle structure and bone structure. That's the theory. That's the theory. But you're absolutely right. If you put somebody in hibernation, they will still be losing muscle mass and bone mass.
Okay. Well, could you do that nanotechnology thing while they're still alive and, I mean, awake and functioning, or do they have to be in hibernation to do it, I wonder?
Oh, no, you're talking about the nanotechnology.
Yeah, since you raised that issue, that's as an alternative, I guess. Could that be done while they're functioning and conscious, or do they have to be in a hibernative state or something in order to do that?
No, they could be awake. That's one way of doing it. I mean, like I say, One question I ask my students is, you know, are baseline humans not cut out for long-duration space travel? Do we have to tweak them a little bit, maybe do some genetic engineering and maybe use nanotech, you know, augment basically, so enhance baseline humans so they can actually tolerate long-duration space flight?
Could you treat osteoporosis with that on Earth?
You could. Like I say, the pioneers of this are two guys called, I think it's Richard Phoenix and Robert Freitas, and I actually mentioned that in a couple of books I've written, and they developed what's called a vasculoid, which is this nanotechnological device that you would inject into the body, and these little nanobots would go to work doing whatever you task them to do, whether it's maintaining bone structure, maintaining muscle function, repair work, obviously, and that sort of thing.
Huh. John, what more?
Well, okay, then I guess we address radiation. I guess the nanotechnology type thing could be used to deal with radiation damage and either eliminate cells that were damaged or repair genes, or could that would be another application, I guess, that might be possible.
Well, they're looking at, we have some very, very radiation-resistant organisms. We have tardigrades. I mean, you can send these guys up into space and bring them back down again, and they're still alive. I mean, it's incredible. And it's not so much the radiation-resistant. It's the rate at which they can repair radiation damage. That's the key. And so these extremophiles, which is a category of organisms that are very resistant to extreme environments, their repair mechanisms are 1,000 times more effective than the repair mechanisms that we have in our body. And so if you extrapolate this to applying this to enhancing the human, you would say, right, well, we can take these extremophiles and we can look at their repair mechanisms and we can integrate these repair mechanisms into a human. So if they are affected by radiation, which they will be, then their repair mechanisms can repair that damage much, much quicker than our traditional human repair mechanisms.
Hmm. Oh, fascinating. Well, that's interesting stuff. Well, somebody else was trying to get in to talk to you, and I must have jumped in front of all. Grab the line and see if they want to get in.
Thank you very much, John. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Listeners, you too can use the telephone. And hopefully that person with the phone line problem will call back. We'd like to hear from you, and hopefully you have a better phone line. Sorry for that. 1-866-687-7223. Tim sent in a note, and he's saying, what about putting the hibernation people in while rotating them in a short-length centrifuge? So I guess you're hibernating in a centrifuge. How does that work out?
That would be the ideal solution, actually, yeah.
It would be the what?
That would be the ideal solution, yeah.
But that's not happening. No work on that or anything like that, right?
Well, but people can find out for themselves where the technology is, because you just go online and you can see what SpaceWorks has published in the last few years. I mean, they do present at these conferences and they explain where their level of technology is for human hibernation, and you can find out where the level of technology is for artificial gravity. And with all these exotic technologies, it takes time. It just takes a lot of time. And funding is relatively limited for this sort of technology in terms of when we would have a realizable functioning hibernation system and artificial gravity system. I'm thinking probably 20 years from now, maybe.
I have one more question, Eric, and this is from Jazz, J-A-Z-Z. It's a person's name, New York City, and says, your best guess of a plausible, realistic timeline, humans walking on Mars.
So SpaceX say they're going to send their first unmanned mission in 4 years. So add two to that, that's 2026. If that goes well, then they might send their first mission or first manned mission in the next launch window, which is 26 months later. 2028. I think that's the absolute earliest you'd see a manned mission to Mars.
Would you go on it?
Yeah, I'd go. I think, huge risk, but I'd volunteer for that.
But you'd want to come back. You wouldn't go one way, correct?
I'd want to come back, but whether that's going to happen is
up in the deep space.
It's like going back 100 years to these Antarctic expeditions. A lot of those people who volunteered for those expeditions to the Antarctic, they knew there was a good chance they weren't coming back because they were so risky. And it's the same with the Mars mission. It is an extremely risky mission.
Yeah, but it's different if you are going with the intention of coming back, but you know that may not happen, or going and you intentionally are going for a one-way mission, you're planning to take up residence on Mars.
Well, I'd want to come back.
Okay, so that okay, Eric, we're pretty much at the end of the show. What have we omitted or missed, or what else would you like to add before we say goodnight and hope that space happens faster than it's planning to happen?
Well, no, just these things take time, and your patience is something that a lot of people don't have especially when it comes to a manned mission to Mars, because we've been promised this for such a long time. I mean, back in the 1960s, we were supposed to be going to Mars in 1984. 36 years ago, and we're doesn't seem that much closer right now. But fortunately, we have the Mars Messiah, as I like to call him, Elon Musk, hard at work, and I think he's probably our best bet for actually
The Mars Messiah.
That's right.
Are your students impatient? What do they think, or are they absolutely fine about waiting?
Sorry, who?
Your students in your classes, are they impatient for humans to Mars?
I see a lot of Occupy Mars T-shirts around the campus, so I know there's a lot of SpaceX fans there because we have students who work for SpaceX. So there's a lot of fans of SpaceX on the campus, you know. But they tend to be a little bit impatient. They seem I keep on telling them, look, you can't believe everything you're told in terms of the timelines because these timelines have a habit of trending towards the right. So I just have to be patient.
When is your next book coming out?
That's going to be the second edition of SpaceX. So the first one came out in, I think, 2010. That was SpaceX making commercial spaceflight a reality. And the second edition is going to cover, obviously, Crew Dragon and the Starship. So there's two chapters dedicated to the Starship and another chapter dedicated to Crew Dragon.
When do you think it'll come out?
Well, what we wanted to do, because there was a chapter in the original book, which was the space race between SpaceX and Boeing. So we wanted to wait until both of them had flown an operational mission. So SpaceX is going to do that next month, but Boeing is delayed. And so, I mean, I'll start writing it next. I'll start writing the updates next year, but we'd like to have it published after Boeing's first operational mission, which probably isn't going to be for another year. Sometime next year, but toward the end of next year.
Well, let me know. We'd love to talk to you on air about it, okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, well, Eric, thank you for coming back. We've missed you for the past couple of years, and it's great that you're still actively writing and as well as teaching. So we look forward to more, and stay healthy and well down there in Florida, and let me wish you a happy Thanksgiving. We're almost there in holiday season, and let's stay in touch. Not sure when we'll get back to in-person space conferences where we might run into one another again, but I hope that happens. I'm not as big a fan on the virtual side as I am of being in person, so...
Well, thanks again, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric, and we'll stay in touch, and the best to you, and I look forward to more of your book reviews, and we appreciate your coming back on.
Hey, thanks again, David.
Okay. Listeners, that's it for today, so I want everybody to have a great rest of the weekend, a good week coming up. Stay healthy. There's a lot of virus seems to be coming back around, so don't totally dismiss it, and just watch out. We need you around to be healthy. And think space show when you're thinking about end-of-the-year activities. This is, for all practical purposes, we're in our annual fundraising campaign right now. So everybody, goodbye from Eric. Goodbye from David. Goodbye from the space show. And we thank all of you who called, all of you who sent in emails. Have a great week. Now remember, Mars is still visible. It's still pretty close to Earth. So when you keep looking up, go keep looking up at night, you know, probably after 9 o'clock at night, and take a look at Mars. You can't miss it if you have clear skies. Everybody, talk to you on Tuesday on our next Space Show program. Once again, goodbye from Eric, David, and the Space Show.